Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Pamela Constable, who is the deputy foreign editor of the Washington Post and author of Fragments of Grace. Pamela, welcome to Berkeley.
Delighted to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I'm from Connecticut, a New Englander for the first half of my life, and then moved to the Washington area a long time ago. I've actually been living in the greater Washington area now for about half my life.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
That's a good question. I would say that the most important thing, most important value that I received from my parents was two things. One, compassion for others, but the other of which was not only can you be a success and should you be a success, but because you come from a background of great privilege, that you owe it to the world to do something with the gifts you've been given. That was very strongly part of my upbringing, was that of responsibility that comes with privilege.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little about your education. Did you have any teachers or mentors, as you say, in high school that really pointed you in the direction of journalism and writing?
I had two, but they were before that. Mm. My sixth grade English teacher, Wally Ramsey, who lives in California, retired to Pebble Beach some years ago, with whom I'm still in close touch. And my ninth grade English teacher, Bill Maris, who passed away some years ago, but who remained a faithful correspondent of the written word with me until he died. And they really instilled in me a very early love of language and of writing, and I really consider them to be mentors more than professors and teachers that I had after that.
Mm-hmm. And the story of your writing and of this book, which we'll talk about a bit, is kind of the linking of these two things, compassion and the word, the importance of telling the story.
That's right. I try throughout this book, whatever I'm writing about, whatever country, whatever situation I find myself in this book, I try to find a moment or a person or a situation that's redeeming, that has some beauty, some grace, some nobility to it, particularly in places of great conflict and turmoil and suffering and cruelty.
Mm-hmm. Now, where were you educated? Where did you do your undergraduate work?
I went to Brown University, graduated in 1974. Many people ask, you know, why I didn't go to journalism school. The answer is that I didn't particularly think I needed to, and I don't really believe in becoming too much of an expert or sort of, I'm a firm believer in middle brow journalism. Mm-hmm. I think we really ought to be dilettantes. We ought to be jacks of all trades, rather than experts, and I was eager to set out on my working life.
Mm-hmm. And you, it was very clear to you that you were going to go to journalism by the time you graduated?
Yes. I worked on student newspapers really since I was in ninth grade and all the way through high school and college, and all my summers in college I worked on newspapers and the Brown Daily Herald. I was an editor there, and my first newspaper job, which was when I was a sophomore, I think the summer of my sophomore year at Brown, I worked as I think the only reporter, as a summer replacement reporter for a tiny little newspaper in Western Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and I was hooked.
Mm-hmm. And then you went to the Boston Globe. Was that your first job as a journalist?
Or? No, not at all. I started after graduation. I started at a small daily newspaper in the capital of Maryland, the Annapolis Evening Capital, and then went on to the Baltimore Sun, where I worked for a number of years, and then went to the Boston Globe in 1982, and then changed to the Washington Post in 1994.
And your first major foreign assignment was in Latin America for the Globe.
That's right. I went to my first overseas assignment was El Salvador. I went to El Salvador in 1983, and then covered the rest of Central America, numerous visits, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and then branched out to South America. America, and then also to the Caribbean, and visited those countries repeatedly.
Your book, which I will show the audience, Fragments of Grace, and you just explained where the title comes from, is an amazing joining of two themes. One is a personal journey, the story of your life and your commitment to journalism, but the main part of the book is about your assignments for the Washington Post in South Asia during a very important period of time, which we'll talk about in a second. But I want to explore something that emerges in the book, which is what it means to be a foreign correspondent. So give us your analysis, drawing on your experience in this line of work, as to what does it take to do this? What are the skills you need? What is the temperament you have to have to be a foreign correspondent?
Somebody told me just before I took my first assignment overseas, being a foreign correspondent means taking off from airports with no one to say goodbye and landing in airports with no one to say hello. Mm-hmm. And this was said half in jest to sort of discourage me from going abroad, but it didn't. I would say that the main qualities you have to have are, the most important being initiative. I mean, you are constantly in situations where you literally may land somewhere knowing no one. Not only are you responsible for finding out what's happening in that place, often very quickly, and often by the end of the day, or at the most 2 days, you have to produce something that's authoritative. Now, as I always say, it's the first draft of history, not the second, but still, it has to be mm-hmm. as authoritative as possible in a very short time. And I give the example of the massacre of the royal family in Nepal, where all of us had to suddenly land, having never been there before, and find out what was happening in an incredibly difficult and hermetic condition, and then write about it within hours. So initiative, the ability to be a self-starter, to imagine, to hit the ground running, to think, now what do I do? Where do I go? How do you get information? To have the imagination and the resourcefulness to just go wherever you need to go and get the job done. You have to have very sharp antenna. You have to always have all your senses on. You have to be a sponge. There, I mixed a few metaphors. Mm-hmm. A sponge with antennas. How's that? Mm-hmm. You always
there
have to.
Must be a creature like that. Yeah.
That's how I think of myself. Yeah. You just have to be very, very sensitive to everything that's happening around you. You know, the walls behind me are blue. That wall is green. You know, you have a mustache. You're wearing brown shoes. I would remember that automatically because it's what I do. All the while thinking about what you're saying, what I'm saying, am I hearing birds outside? Am I hearing a fire engine? Is it, you know, is somebody going to, you know, come in and arrest us? You know, you have to be always thinking of everything at once. So that sort of, you know, 360 degrees of senses you always have to have on. You have to have incredible energy. You have to be able to survive under circumstances of great hardship quite often, of places where there is no soft bed at the end of the day, where there is no hot water to wash your hair, where there may be no bar to have a drink, where you're very much, I wouldn't quite compare it to a sort of military life, but it has aspects of a military life in many cases. I mean, you know, I've gone for months and months without wearing, you know, an attractive set of clothing, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really have to become almost, in some ways, like a soldier.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with that part of the problem that you're confronted with, wherein you don't know the language, you don't know the culture? I mean, you've just been parachuted in. How do you manage the set of tasks of reporting not from Berkeley or from Providence, but from Kabul?
You know, when I first went to Afghanistan, there were no telephones. Of course, there was no internet. There were no numbers on the houses. There were no government ministries. There were no spokesmen of any kind. And you didn't know what was happening.
And this would have been what year?
1998. Not only that, there was a hostile government which didn't want you there in the first place and
the
had
Taliban,
you under incredible scrutiny all the time, the Taliban authorities, with guides and guards and all sorts of restrictions, terrible restrictions on what we could do. You weren't allowed to interview private citizens, weren't allowed to interview women, weren't allowed to take photographs, weren't allowed to go to private homes, weren't allowed to leave your hotel after dark or before the daylight. Just very, very circumscribed conditions. And so, you know, you really were scrounging and struggling all the time. And so, you know, I did a lot of what I did during those visits was, I mean, I'd almost use the word stealth. I mean, I would duck into a shop and talk to someone for 5 minutes and then leave. Mm-hmm. I used to keep my camera literally hidden under my veils. I wore lots and lots of veils, many layers of clothing to cover my shape. And I would hide my camera underneath and I would take a single photograph and then put it back again. Mm-hmm. I did that all the time. So just using all these skills that I never thought I'd need, you know, spy-like skills of great unobtrusiveness and just seizing the moment. And of course, it became better once the Taliban left and the officials were no longer hostile. They were quite welcoming. But still, it was a very difficult culture. I mean, it's once you're outside the main cities of a country like Kabul, it's still very difficult to interview women. Even being a woman, I've often had to interview women through doors and through windows because they really weren't allowed to see or to be with strangers. It was usually because I had a male translator, and so the men in the home didn't want the women to be seen by the male translator. And of course, I didn't speak Pashto. I speak a little Dari, but not much Pashto. So it was always these logistical conundra that you had to deal with. So great challenges of working in a country like that, and always having to rack your brains to sort of find ways to do the basic task.
And as you're on certain reporting assignments, you really are dependent on translators, right? I know in Latin America you probably knew Spanish, but when you're traveling in South Asia, where there's so many different people, so many languages in one country, you must really depend on translating.
You do. I mean, that was always, you know, I was, if I had any hesitation about working in the Middle East and in South Asia, it was language, because I don't like to be at a loss. I don't like to be surrounded by people who are, I don't want to be in a mob or in a street demonstration where I can't understand the chatter around me. Mm. I don't like to miss jokes. I don't like to miss side comments. I don't like to do just formal interviews where you control it, you know, and yes, sir, no, sir, and, you know, what's your opinion about X? I really like to be able to feel a society, and to do that, you know, in Latin America, I never had any problems. I could always find some language in common. In fact, one of my favorite, this is an aside, one of my favorite anecdotes about Latin America is I'm sitting on a beach in Rio de Janeiro interviewing some people about the upcoming elections, and was pretty pleased with myself because I had sort of managed to turn my Spanish into Portuguese and was sort of getting through just fine. And at the end of the interview, I discovered that they were tourists from Rome and we'd all been speaking Italian. It worked out. But, you know, you get into Urdu, you get into Arabic, you get into Punjabi and Telugu and, you know, whole sorts of new languages, you can't possibly do anything more than break the ice and learn how to say hello, how are you? So depending heavily on translators, which is a big problem, not because they're hard to find, but because good ones are hard to find. And, you know, constantly, you know, you get a translator who says, well, this was an interesting man, but he wasn't terribly articulate. Let me tell you what he meant. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not what I want. I want somebody who will tell me every word, every every ah, you know, every aside. Some of the best things you get out of interviews are the things people don't intend to say or think you haven't heard or actually turned to their buddy and said when they thought you weren't listening, you know, I want all that. Mm-hmm. And you need all that to be a good journalist.
Mm-hmm. What are the particular challenges for a woman as a foreign correspondent. I know there have been, over the years, and even before you started your career, there were a number of distinguished, I think Flora Lewis, you know, and others. So there was a tradition there. Mm-hmm. But during the period that you've done your work, things were still changing for women, more opportunities. But were there particular challenges that that stand out, or once you hit, when the tire hits the road, maybe these things don't matter unless you're in a society that frowns on the engagement of women in different professions?
I would say in Latin America it was pretty much never an issue. I mean, there were plenty of women journalists in Latin America, both foreigners and from those countries. It was a profession that women had worked in for quite a long time, actually, in Latin America. So I never sort of felt out of place or uncomfortable particularly. I mean, there were many difficult times, but usually they weren't particularly related to, I mean, sometimes you have to sleep, you know, in a tent with, you know, soldiers and stuff, and you get through it. The problem really came in the Muslim world, when I entered the Muslim world 6 years ago and began having to live in that sort of culture and to do a professional job which required, you know, taking notes and going difficult places and dealing with people as equals and getting access to officials, etc. And also being deferential to the culture. I mean, being deferential to a culture in which very, very, very few women did anything remotely like what I do, and where, you know, to be a woman to request an interview with someone and to sit there at a table across from them like this, taking notes, asking questions, perhaps asking tough questions, demanding questions, all these things were unheard of. Not in India, of course. I'm not speaking about India. I'm really talking about, you know, Muslim societies here in particular. So, you know, the way I handled it, and even with the Taliban, actually, in Afghanistan, we sort of got around the whole thing, and this is sort of unspoken. Basically, I pretended to be a man, and basically they pretended that I was a man. Mm-hmm. And so we dealt with each other, the authorities and I, and you know, as if, for all intents and purposes, I was just like them. Mm-hmm. And I always dressed, you know, very modestly, very conservatively. You know, I learned very quickly not to shake people's hands. You know, after you do this a number of times and nobody takes your hand, you learn not to stick it out anymore.
And this is because you're a woman.
Because I'm a woman. People didn't want to look me in the face, so I didn't look them in the face. You've trained your whole life, you know, hey, I'm so-and-so. And you have to unlearn that. Mm-hmm. You have to learn to click your eyes down, put your hands in your lap, keep your scarf on your head, you know, wait for the people to finish their tea, and then, you know, have a sort of a silly conversation about their families, and then after a while you can ask a couple of questions. I'm exaggerating here, but not that much. I mean, completely different culture. So you know, by my very existence, in many cases, I was perceived as an oddity and a threat. Not only being a woman, being a journalist, being a Westerner, being a Christian, all the things about me in many situations, especially Taliban Afghanistan and especially conservative Islamic Pakistan, where I spent a great deal of time, you know, I was if not a threat, certainly an oddity, and sometimes both. And so I had to work very hard to overcome that by simply just being as modest and as deferential as I possibly could. And there was one incident that I mentioned in the book where I was interviewing a Taliban official in Afghanistan. I had my scarf on my head, I had all the, you know, the heavy clothing and everything, and I was with another woman journalist. We were old friends, and we were sitting there doing this interview together, and we were very, very tired. We'd been up for two days and nights straight covering a hijacking, and we were very tired. And sometimes you start giggling when you're really tired. So there was the translator made a mistake, and she looked at me, and I looked at her. We started giggling, and tears were rolling down our faces, and we were like kids sitting in this room. And this Taliban authority was so deeply offended at this that he stood up, left the room, dismissed us from the ministry, and never came back, and was highly offended. And I found out several years later, he'd actually written a formal protest to the foreign minister. For giggling.
Yeah. Well, maybe you were showing your humanity.
I was showing something. I don't know what.
The interesting question becomes, you're saying in a way that every place is different for a foreign correspondent, and you have to be have the skills of opening all your senses up and finding your location in many different senses. I'm very curious as to in what way your work in Latin America, where you went to all sorts of places, you were covering the most developed areas and also places in turmoil and chaos like Haiti. Mm-hmm. In what sense did that prepare you for your experience when you became the Washington Post's South Asia bureau chief in the late 1990s, but in what sense it didn't?
Mm-hmm. No, it is a good question. In some ways it was, as I said, everything was completely new, language, culture, religion. I was totally unprepared for the degree to which religion dictated the daily lives of people that I was suddenly dealing with. I went from essentially a very secular part of the world to a very religious part of the world. No matter what the religion was, I had never understood the degree to which religion was going to dominate my work. I'd almost never written about religion.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very different. But as I said at another event today, being a professional, being out on the road, being on your own, being in difficult places for many years, it essentially prepares you for anything. I could be in China tomorrow, and I would do the same set of things that I would do if tomorrow I was sent to, Antarctica. And that would be, I'd look for the nearest newspaper office and ask to talk to a local reporter to get help from them. I'd probably invite them to dinner if I could and get some contacts and get a sense of the lay of the land. I would make a point of spending a few days, if I had the luxury, of just going out, going to local restaurants. There are a number of things you automatically do as a journalist to get a sense of where you are. In an emergency, there are certain kinds of people that you have to contact. Obviously, you have to contact embassies. You have to contact local journalists. You have to contact very often local politicians or police. In a place like Afghanistan, I can't tell you how many times I have been to provinces and districts that were completely strange to me, where I was going because there had been a bombing or a massacre or some problem. The first place I would go would be the police station, and usually that's where I slept, because there were never hotels in these places, no such thing. And invariably, the police chief and the local district authority would have a room with cushions on the floor. And so anybody who came through, whether it was a tax collector or me, that's where you stayed. So you get used to that. You get used to going certain places for help. When you don't have, a modern society with cell phones and spokesmen and offices and hotels and all that, you find substitutes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was most surprising with regard to the importance of religion in people's lives? Because I want to draw out this distinction, because clearly in Latin America, there are a lot of religious folks, in the Christian and Catholic faith and so on. But I think you're suggesting something else, and I think it's something that comes out in what you write about India, which of course is mainly Hindu and not Islamic. So, although there are large numbers of Muslims in India, talk a little more about that. Maybe give us a concrete example of what you're trying to suggest.
Latin America is more like the United States in that sense that, most people are at least nominally religious. They belong to a faith. Most people in Latin America are Roman Catholic. But it doesn't mean that they wake up every morning thinking, I'm a Roman Catholic. It means that, maybe if you're an older woman, you might go to Mass a couple of mornings a week. If you're a man, maybe you'll go once a month. If you're a teenager, you might not go at all. Mm-hmm. It's something that shapes your beliefs but does not affect your daily life particularly. In the Muslim world, you live and breathe Islam all the time. And I'm not speaking about fanaticism. I'm not speaking about mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda. I'm speaking about the things you think and feel every day that inform your actions. You know, many, many people do pray five times a day, or at least twice. You've got to close your shop, you've got to skip class, you've got to get your kid out of school. You know, Islam is very inconvenient, and it's deliberately inconvenient. If you've ever lived through a Ramadan, you would know. If you really ever observed a real Ramadan, I've done it twice now. I've been in many Ramadans, so I've only observed it twice. I mean, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It's a pain in the neck. I mean, you have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and cook, mm-hmm. you know, and then after that you don't eat until sundown, by which time everybody is ravenous, and God forbid you should be in a traffic jam when it gets to be 4:57 and it's time to eat. You know, people stop their cars in the middle of the street and go try to find a McDonald's. I mean, it's a mess. Deliberately so. The purpose of Ramadan is to remind us what it's like to go hungry, and to make us appreciate, to put a higher priority on our faith than on what's convenient for our lives. It makes you think about that. Mm-hmm. You know, we in the West, we make our holidays work around weekends. You know, if there's a holiday on a Friday or Wednesday, we make it on a Friday so we can have a long weekend. Think of Islam as the opposite. If it were on a Friday, they'd make it on a Wednesday. I mean, they really try hard to make it be a religion that makes you think and feel your faith. There's a big debate now in many Muslim societies about the constraints and the taboos that govern people's lives. To what extent are they religious, and to what extent are they cultural? It's a hard thing to prize apart. But, for example, if you talk about the restrictions on women, you know, arranged marriages, the right to divorce, all the issues, the right for men to have multiple wives, all these issues, there are people who, you can find arguments in the Quran for and against all of them. The Quran is mm-hmm. this big, amorphous, multiply interpreted and wide open to interpretation text, as well as the Hadith and other things around it. I'm not convinced, and a lot of people I know are not convinced, that Islam is all that restrictive on the behavior of women and the actions of women. However, many, many, many Muslims, especially men, especially in traditional rural societies, are convinced of this and behave as if it were true, when in fact it's really the dictates of their tribal and cultural imperatives. So it's a little bit apples and oranges sometimes, mm-hmm. but the bottom line is that as a result of this culture and that and very traditional interpretations of Islam, you have situations in which women are very restricted in what they can do. I mean, as I was saying before, I mean, where does it say in the Quran that, you know, a woman has to be covered in a veil before she leaves her front door? Well, I don't think it's there. This is really something else. Mm-hmm. This is really tribal culture, pre-literate tribal culture. But there it is. It's very difficult to get anything done, I know, because I've tried. Twice I've tried to do my job wearing a full veil. It is very difficult. You cannot see. You can't wear eyeglasses because, of course, why would a woman need eyeglasses anyway? Mm-hmm. You can't see. You can't hear. You can't walk. How can you take notes? How can you take photographs? It's not possible to do my job mm-hmm. and wear, you know, a full veil. So we're talking about incredible strictures on activity and behavior, and it's always in the back of your mind all the time. You can't say, I'm going to wait till Sunday to do this.
You're suggesting that there may be power relations with Islam that preclude exposure to the diversity that may actually be possible within Islamic texts. Is that
yes, and it's true. I mean, even within countries like Egypt is a good example. Pakistan is a good example. I mean, in Karachi there are nightclubs. In Karachi, you see girls in jeans and you know, very
modern,
ultra-modern clothing. Women are engineers and doctors and lawyers. People go to discos. But, you know, you're in a little village in Pakistan, and you can be murdered for flirting. Mm-hmm. Not only can you be murdered for flirting, but no judge or policeman would ever arrest you for that. It's part of the culture. Mm-hmm. There's a very famous case right now that's still going through the courts in Pakistan of a woman who, it's a complicated story, but basically...
She was raped, is it?
She was raped. She was gang raped on the orders of a tribal council as vengeance for the fact that a young cousin of hers had been seen flirting with another girl in a field. Mm-hmm. The tribal council ordered that sentence upon her. It was carried out by five guys, and nobody did a thing. Everybody knew about it until the press found out. Mm-hmm. And it's all gone through the courts, and it's very controversial because in tribal culture, this is the norm. This is what's accepted. Mm-hmm. Same place... I mean, Karachi, people drink like fish in Pakistan.
Yeah.
But alcohol is very much verboten, and there are no bars. You cannot buy a drink in Pakistan. It's a lot of hypocrisy, mm-hmm. a lot of hypocrisy.
It sounds like there's a special responsibility on the shoulders of a journalist like yourself in this clash of cultures. I'm not implying there's a clash of civilizations in the way that Huntington suggests. And of course, you were parachuted down, if I can use that in quotes, to become bureau chief of South Asia before in the late 90s, before 9/11. You visit Afghanistan before 9/11, and so you are witnessing a number of changes in which your country of origin, the United States, and for which newspapers you're reporting, have really changed its view of Islam and adopted a whole set of policies. Where I'm getting at, it strikes me that you have a special responsibility, which, knowing you, I'm sure you realize in all its possibilities, to essentially tell the story of Islamic people, of women, of communities, of villages, of a religious ceremony, in such a way that open up our understanding of what's going in the Islamic world, because the policy may be closing down some of these insights as it tries to create a black and white world and an adversary. It's a long question, but you see where
no,
I'm going.
No, I do, and I did take that very seriously, and I really, you do try hard, and I've been in, you know, violent demonstrations, you know, anti-American demonstrations when I was surrounded by people stomping on straw dummies of President Bush, and my job is to interview them and find out how they feel, mm-hmm. and I do. And I've had many interviews with Islamic clerics and others who, you know, are very, very anti-American and who think that we're all decadent infidels and... of course, obviously the most extreme were the Taliban, but and my job was to listen politely and to take in their point of view and to represent that back to my readers. Now, I always tried very hard to, not only, as I said before, find out what's good and redeeming about all the places that I lived and worked, but also to try to find a balance between the good and the bad. I mean, there were a lot of things about Islam that were very appealing to me. Its spirituality, its asceticism, its emphasis on charity, the fact that, you know, you go into a mosque, it's very quiet, it's very contemplative, it's very serene. My first exposure to Hinduism, it was like going to a three-ring circus. I mean, I didn't think there was anything spiritual about it at all until I'd been in India for some time and had some very moving experiences with Hinduism. But, you know, there's elephants and monkeys and incense and flowers and beggars all over the place, and you think, what is this? There's a lot about Islam that's very appealing. It's very it really wants you to get down to the essence of things and care about the values that matter. So I try to reflect that in what I wrote, as well as the terrible stuff and the bombings and the radicalism and the terrible manipulation of average people by politically motivated Islamic leaders. I mean, that's what's really, I mean, I've said this before, and if there's going to be a clash of civilization, it's going to be within Islam. It's going to be within countries like Pakistan, mm-hmm. which are trying to modernize on the one hand, but are also very, very weighted by the pull of tradition and by the pull of radical Islam, because the appeal of radical Islam to poor, alienated people who have no chance for an education or for a decent job or for any sort of place in the bureaucracy, what do they have? What do they have beside the promise of paradise, and how do you get to paradise? Mm-hmm. I understand that appeal now. I've heard it enough times from enough people who had nothing else, and I've tried to convey that too.
And I guess a key insight here is, on the one hand, the universal appeal of Islam, but on the other hand, the way different cultural and national settings have shaped the religion in a kind of distinctive way. That seems to be very different, those two elements, from some of the black and white interpretations that come out when you're focused on this fanatical group of terrorists who are a real threat to the United States.
I've tried to bring out all aspects. In fact, you know, I remember I had a friend, a professor in Pakistan. We used to meet often and talk. And I think the last time we met in Pakistan, or maybe it was the second time, last time we met, there was terrible conflict. This was at the height of, you know, the Iraq occupation, and, you know, terrible controversy about it, and demonstrations, and really a lot of very ugly feelings being expressed, and, you know, the intimidation of immigrants, and, you know, there, a friend of mine from Pakistan who was an editor of a newspaper had just been arrested in Washington. I mean, it was just ridiculous stuff that was going on. And my friend and I looked at each other and said, you know, there may come a time that we won't even be able to speak to each other anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe it would be suspect for us to be even having tea, you know. I mean, that we sort of lamented that. We both felt that you know, to maintain, you know, civilized and diplomatic and intellectual discourse, you know, if they don't let people in anymore, if people keep getting turned down for visas, you know, I remember because he was having trouble with his visa, and he, you know, been to the United States a dozen times, and all of a sudden, you know, the rules were changing and everything was suspicious, and it's a very difficult time now to have normal relations, to sort of, things aren't normal anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to try and keep that up, you know, even in bad times. To try and maintain things like academic exchanges. I mean, some of those have been cut off. I mean, it's, you know, it's very sad, actually.
Mm-hmm. You've been in so many exciting places in this recent phase of your career, and we have only an hour. But I'm curious, do you have some sort of way of, and I should say to the audience, you were Kabul bureau chief, you were in Afghanistan, you've obviously been in Pakistan and in India, and you also were in Iraq after the initiation of the war, and then during the period afterward. Do you have some way of conveying to us one experience that sort of stands out from all of this that captures this phase of your career? It's a very unfair question, but I mean it. I'm curious as if there's some event that some reporting that you did that really stands out in your own mind.
Well, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
There are several.
Yeah.
One was the, I was in the middle of this extraordinary Hindu festival in the south of India in the winter of 2000. There were millions and millions and millions of people, you know, in this one river. And it was probably the most uplifting experience I'd ever had. It was like being in the middle of a mass reverie. It was like you know, Woodstock. It was like going to heaven. It was this amazing. There was no food. There were no bathrooms. everybody was just happy. Mm-hmm. It was just this incredibly spiritual mass experience. And right in the middle of covering that, we found out there'd been this horrific earthquake in the north of India. And we all of us, all the journalists, had to rush from this, you know, harmonious, you know, mass experience up to this incredibly destructive and tragic natural catastrophe. It really made me think a lot about God and about faith and about fate and about all those things. It was quite a shock. It was quite a shock to go from one to the other. And I think that week, the first half of which was spent covering a festival, the second of which half of which was spent covering an incredibly horrific loss of life in the same country by the same group of people or among the same group of people of that same faith, was quite a learning experience for me. The other thing I remember being particularly dramatic was coming into Afghanistan after the Taliban fell. When 9/11 happened, I happened to be in South Africa in a game reserve observing white rhinoceroses. I was on my first day of vacation after a reporting trip to South Africa, and I rushed back to Johannesburg and then up to Pakistan and then spent basically a month trying to get into Afghanistan. And there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of journalists, and we were all trying to get into Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were going to find. Mm-hmm. We really didn't know what we were going to find. And finally, I mean, we were just camped on the border basically for weeks and weeks and weeks. And finally, they just gave up and let us in, by which I mean the Pakistani border authorities finally said, okay, you want to go get killed? Just go. Just leave us alone. And so we all rushed through the border, and it was late at night. It was very dark. We were hearing all these reports on the radio. There was fighting ahead. We didn't know whether the Taliban were still in control or not. We didn't know whether the coalition forces were in control. And we all rushed over the border, and I was in this old school bus, which had been rented by some journalists, and we're sort of heading in the darkness into what we didn't know. And we see all these, you know, shapes in the darkness, these men with turbans, and they're milling around, and you can see they all have Kalashnikovs, and they have rocket launchers and, you know, SAM missiles, and it's very dark and very scary. And the bus comes to a halt, and we're surrounded by all these men, and I've got my translator next to me, and you know, a bunch of these guys, they force their way onto the bus, and these enormous tribesmen, you know, very woolly looking guys with these big Russian assault rifles, and they're murmuring and all jabbering along in Pashto. And the leader of the group gets up, and he's standing in the front of the bus like this with this big, you know, enormous gun and this scowl in his face, this big beard, this big turban, and he says something, and my translator breaks out into a big smile. And I said, what did he say? And he said, welcome to Afghanistan.
I see.
So this was not the Taliban. This was the other side. And from there, we more or less got in okay. But, it's a moment I will never forget.
a lot of this is captured in the book, I should tell your audience. But I did want to point out that the book is has different chapters on the different places with the same sort of depth of understanding and complexity, but also telling stories that are quite fascinating. But interspersed with that is a personal journal about your own life and how you found meaning in the context of these experiences. It's very well written, and it strikes me as being very courageous to try to do something like that, and then wonderful to succeed at doing it. So I wonder if you could talk a little about that. In other words, that because I think there seems to be an interplay between these experiences and the meaning that you would find drawing on these experiences, but returning home, basically, and reconciling yourself to the choices that you've made. That's a very poor summary, but it's an effort on my part to open up a little discussion of it. It was hard to write, wasn't it?
It was very hard to write. When the book started coming out and people had read various chapters of it or were commenting, and people told me that it was a brave book to write, and I realized that they were not talking about, you know, the Taliban. They
right,
were not
being,
talking
yeah,
about,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, civil wars. The hardest parts of the book to write were the personal parts. There were sentences that took me a week to write.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, the book was very cathartic, it was very therapeutic, and it was really an effort by me to come to grips with my life. I mean, I had just turned 50, and I thought, well, I better decide, has it all been worth it? I really wanted to pause, and you know, as I said before, a number of my friends had, colleagues had been killed. The immediate impetus for the book was the fact that I was with a group of journalists in Afghanistan, four of them were killed, and I decided I really wanted to take some time off and write about the thrill and the cost of what I do, the risk you take and whether it's worth it. And I try to do that by writing about these returns back to the States. And every time I came back to the States, which is usually roughly once a year or twice a year, I was shocked. I was always shocked at the luxury, at the opulence, at the size of people's homes, the size of people's cars, the choices they had to make, the luxuriousness. I mean, the lights always seemed so bright, you know, and the roads always seemed so smooth, and my hair always felt much better. And, you know, all those things were so different. And I always wished every time that I could just take the entire country with me back to Afghanistan, especially people under about the age of 16, so that they would see what it's like to live in many other parts of the world. But, you know, as time passed, and I came back again and again, I also saw that the United States was changing. And I also saw that each time I came back, especially after 9/11, and then especially after the occupation of Iraq, that the country had changed very dramatically while I'd been gone. I mean, I didn't have a television in Afghanistan. I wasn't reading newspapers. So I was very much immersed in a conflicted but very isolated part of the world, while back home, the whole sort of ethos of the era was changing. The United States is much more conservative than it was when I left 6 years ago. It's much more frightened. It's much more intolerant. It doesn't like the press. It doesn't trust the press as much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I represent an institution and a profession of which I'm very proud. But if you took a survey today, you'd find the number of people that feel that way about even, you know, the mainstream press is, you know, far less than it was when I left. There have been many shocks, actually, now that I'm back full-time. I've only been back 3 months, but it is a very different country than when I left.
Mm-hmm. And now you have this role. You're wearing a new hat. You're deputy foreign editor of the Washington Post, and before you were a foreign correspondent for the Washington Post. So I guess the interesting question then becomes, you must have gotten a lot of experience editing your own book as you were trying to grapple with the places you've covered and the personal stuff. But now you're in the position of editing the stories from Kabul, from New Delhi, from Karachi. And you're wearing a different hat, but presumably as a person of empathy, you sort of see things based on the fact that you were out there. So I guess the question, we'll go back to the question, so what does it take to be an editor and to do it well, drawing on this body of experience being out there and having been edited?
Mm-hmm. It's, you have a lot of empathy. I mean, you know, I'm constantly having to wake people up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I remember what it's like to be woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning when you've been working very hard. I'm constantly being in the position of reviewing material that is really written from the heart. It's very dramatic. It's very colorful. It's very exciting. It's very compelling. And it's my job, you know, to take out the adjectives that are either too opinionated or too over the top. It's my job to sort of wrestle a very dramatic piece of work into something that is more manageable, more organized, more logical, more carefully written. It's more what's the word I'm looking for? It's careful in the allegations that it makes. It doesn't accuse people of things. It has good sources. It has good attributions. It has caveats built into it. So my job now is to take the kind of exciting material that I used to send and make it presentable and make it publishable. And that's, as my editor never tires of telling me, an entirely selfless task because my name is not on anything anymore. So you have to be pretty mature, I think, to do it, and you have to not care so much about your name being on it. And you know, when you're out in the middle of nowhere year after year after year, all you have is your name on the story because nobody knows what you've been through. But now I know. Now I know what it takes. And I'm happy to be helping these younger correspondents get through it. I have a lot more empathy than I would have. Maybe that's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. And how has journalism changed? You touched on this a minute ago, but what are the pressures that you see on American journalism as it covers the world? It's probably a lot easier to get foreign stories on the front page of the Post now, but are there a new set of pressures, both because you are in a war capital, presumably, in the sense we are a country at war?
Yes, it's a very big topic. I would say yes, you're right. The upside is that foreign news is now very, very dominant, and there's lots of interest in it, which for long periods of time has not been the case. Everything I wrote from Afghanistan or from Iraq, there was great hunger for. I never had to fight to get my stories in the paper. There's always great interest in these foreign stories. But I would say that the pressures we face now are completely other, and there are two of them. One of which is that there's now much more competition within the media. The media has now exploded into this. It's now becoming multimedia, and very, very much fewer people read newspapers now than they used to, or read at all. I'm afraid than they used to. I can't produce something that's better and faster now than anyone else because it's already out there. By the time you put your pen to your paper, it's already been all over the internet, and we have much more competition now than we ever did before. And it's not necessarily positive competition. Some of it's very destructive competition. We now are under incredible scrutiny more than ever before because we're also living at a time in which I think there's more government suspicion of the press and more government pressure for the press to be conformist than in most recent times. So we've got pressure from above in which we have to be extra careful. We've had a number of scandals in the press, even in the mainstream press, of plagiarism and this sorts of problems. So we have to be more careful than ever to make sure that what we write is true, or if we can't be sure, we better say so. We have to have a lot more caveats now, I think, in what we're producing. At the same time, we have to be more entertaining, more compelling, more dramatic to get people to read. So there's this constant tug of war now between these two, in many ways, competing pressures, and it really is, it's a really difficult time for the press.
So one final question then, if students were watching this program and they listen to your this account of your odyssey and they said, yeah, I think I want to do that. How would you advise them to prepare for a future as a foreign correspondent?
Well, I certainly wouldn't necessarily say they should go to journalism school. I usually tell young people, if you think it's something you might like to do, drop everything, get a little savings, and go live in Upper Volta for a year. Just live. If you can get a job as a radio stringer or a wire stringer or some hometown newspaper stringer, don't think about the money. If you can take a year and go live in a very difficult place and learn new things, learn a new language, learn a new culture, see if you like the excitement and the hardship of doing it. That's a much better education and preparation than anything you could learn in any sort of graduate school. If you know how to write, if you like to write, if you think you want to be a foreign correspondent, just go try it. Just go try living in a place where there's no hair conditioner or air conditioner, where you may not have access to the internet, where you may not have a choice about what you eat, where you may have to eat with your hands, where there may be no electricity on a very, very, very hot night. I mean, see how you like it. And if you still want to do the job because you're so excited to be in the middle of a conflict or a war or a life and death struggle or a place where people are suffering or dying of AIDS or cholera, if that's what really makes you feel that you're a witness to history and what you're doing is compelling enough that you don't care about your personal, not safety, but health and appearance, then I think that's the best preparation you can get.
Well, on that note of advice, Pamela, I want to thank you very much for taking the time for visiting the campus, appearing on our program, and thank you for writing Fragments of Grace.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Thank you, and thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.